You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Bill!
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. Good to talk to you, Bill Scher.
I know you have had a great interest in the intellectual decline in conservative media. You have tried to reverse that trend through your own writing and commentary. I believe you were I think you've been critical of Breitbart at times, but now the head of Breitbart has joined the Trump campaign as CEO. A full-blown merging of extreme conservative media and the Republican nominee. Is this just the culmination of everything you have been talking about in your book, Too Dumb to Fail?
As of now, I'm open to ideas. I'm calling it the axis of epistemic closure. And it's Trump ails, reportedly, and Steve Bannon of Breitbart fame.
Right, so Roger Ailes, who was, you know, removed from leading Fox News, is now reportedly advising Trump on debates, but he doesn't have a paid position, correct?
That's my understanding, and there's, you know, the Trump people, I think, are even denying that he's informally advising at all, but it would make sense.
Right.
I mean, Roger Ailes, you know, in his past life, that's what he did. He, in fact, I think, I could be wrong, I think Ailes was brought in 1984 after Reagan had a bad debate. And you know the debate where Reagan told the joke about youth and inexperience with Mondale? I think Ailes might have been part of that debate prep session. I mean, I read his book many years ago, like 15 years ago. I read Ailes' book. So, and I think Zev Chafetz had a book about Roger Ailes that might have been in there too. But he, either way, Ailes is, you know, one of the things that he was, before Fox News, one of the things he was great at was sort of prepping Republican candidates for debates. So I actually think that that would be, you know, we're talking about this staff shakeup and in many ways how problematic it is. But I mean, if Roger Ailes really is going to be doing debate prep for Trump, then I think that's probably really good news. I mean, that's probably a pretty good sign for Trump.
It would be shocking news if Donald Trump was going to do debate prep. I'm not convinced he's going to actually sit there for hours on end and do real debate prep. You know, maybe he's going to have a couple of chats with Roger on the phone or get drinks at a bar. But I have a really hard time. I mean, Trump can barely be trusted to read a teleprompter speech. He's going to actually do several days in a dark room going over specific questions and answers over and over again until he gets it just right. I do not accept that.
Well, there you go again. Well, no, I mean, it doesn't, you make a valid point and you very well may be right. I would say that I think, you know, Kellyanne Conway, who's part of the shakeup, she would certainly be encouraging Trump to do the debate prep. I think Manafort would probably, assuming he still is involved, I mean, he's been given the title, what is it, chairman? I don't even know what his title is.
I think Manafort's campaign chairman.
They've got so many different, there's like a CEO, a campaign manager, and a chairman of this campaign.
Well, it's a good thing that, you know, Trump is bringing his private sector business know-how to how to run a campaign in a government, because clearly he knows exactly how to put a team together and have a clear chain of command so everybody knows what their roles and responsibilities are.
Well, and actually there's been a suggestion that he intentionally doesn't want a chain of command. He doesn't want, because he doesn't want there to be anybody that he sort of has to answer to. I mean, even though you're the boss, if there's a chain of command, there's still some accountability. But by having different sort of power silos, it sort of keeps him from ever, he can, once, if one person turns on the heat and starts pressuring him to do something he doesn't want to do, he can just sort of freeze them out and then turn to his other advisors and sort of have another campaign in waiting. So I think that's a dysfunctional way to lead, but it seems like that may be how he operates.
Well, let's shift back to Bannon here. I mean, Bannon strikes me as sort of the biggest story that, I mean, one, he's being treated as evidence that Trump is not going to moderate. Bannon is someone who would encourage him to be even more provocative and over the top in his attacks. It is a dramatic blurring of the lines of conservative media and Republican politics. I mean, plenty of people talk about those pieces being interlocked for a long time, yeah. But this seems pretty brazen.
And it also suggests that, like, that this didn't happen overnight. I mean, Bannon was informally advising Trump for a long time. Obviously, that raises questions.
Breitbart's been a source of pro-Trump propaganda for a while.
Even siding with Trump over their own reporter, Michelle Fields.
Right.
So this obviously raises questions about objectivity, ethics, all sorts of things like that. Look, it's not unheard of, for people, you know, there is this revolving door, and you have people like Jay Carney who leave the media and go into an administration or even join a campaign. But this is the top guy at a media outlet becoming the top guy on a campaign. I don't, you know, look, I mean, in the past, there were actual reporters who covered FDR who wrote some of his speeches. So I'm not saying that we're in, like, completely uncharted territory here, but this certainly, sort of is counter to, you know, modern sort of journalistic ethics, I would say.
Well, I mean, like a Jay Carney, for example, no one was accusing Jay Carney of being in the tank for Democrats while he was at Time Magazine.
Well, I don't know about that.
He was a respect.
I don't know about that, but anyway, in the modern era, this seems to be unprecedented. I don't know of another example of this. I mean, you know, you got the Stephanopoulos's, moderating debates with Hillary Clinton and them and things like that. That's a different thing. I mean, I'm not saying it's good, but it's different.
So what's a little confusing to me about Bannon, and I'm not coming to this as an expert on his trajectory. I'm catching up like a lot of other people are. There's two big pieces on Bannon. Actually, there's three. It's one I haven't read yet at Vanity Fair that just came out. But there was one from a year ago by Joshua Green at Bloomberg or Bloomberg Business Week the headline was "The Most Dangerous Republican Operative or Conservative Operative in America." It talked about his role in the Clinton cash book. The author there worked for him, and that Bannon had the whole vision that if you were going to really take down Democrats, you had to wrap it in facts. You had to have these investigative scoops, because that was the way for the information to reach mainstream media and not remain ghettoized in conservative circles. And he called it weaponizing the opposition research. And so there was this level of, in the Bloomberg piece, it sort of credited him with this level of sophistication, which is what made him seemingly dangerous. But you know, since that piece and since Clinton cash came out, which, you know, certainly gave, you know, the Clinton campaign some agita, but she has survived it. I would not argue that Breitbart has been a font of sophisticated attacks. It's mostly been seen as a propaganda machine and lots of discredited, outright false, and in some cases, you know, bigoted headlines, you know, calling Bill Kristol a renegade Jew. I thought there was a certain discordance between the profile. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the profile that is really important and notable, but that particular aspect of it strikes me as from not being true today. And then you have this other piece by Ben Shapiro, who used to work, he was a conservative, used to work at Breitbart and quit after the Michelle Fields dust up, basically saying Bannon's this completely noxious character. Who didn't stand up for his reporter? It is totally and is a singular corrosive element in the conservative movement, and just a guy that can't be trusted. So where do you come out of all this? Do you think that Bannon has this level of sophistication that's going to be good for Trump, or is this just hitting rock bottom?
I think I agree with all of it. I mean, I know Steve Bannon a little bit. We're not, we don't play volleyball together on weekends or anything like that. But I met him when his movie The Undefeated came out, the documentary about Sarah Palin. And then I went on his radio show several times. And then I think the last time I talked to him was when that Clinton Cash is at the book when that came out, and I ended up having that guy on my podcast, and I found that guy to be pretty darn persuasive and seemed to be pretty sharp. My take on Bannon is that I think he is simultaneously brilliant and creative, incredibly high energy, but also grandiose. And I think he has this ability. Like my recollection when the Palin documentary came out was that he believed that it was going to be this game changer, and maybe in a slightly delusional way. But he is so charismatic and persuasive that you are inclined to believe him. Apparently he was a Navy officer. Apparently he worked at Goldman Sachs before going this direction, which is sort of, the ironic thing that, so many of these people worked at Goldman Sachs, like Ted Cruz's wife, these populist warriors. So
I mean, Trump even attacked Cruz on that basis, right?
Yeah, right. I think he did. Yeah, I know he did. So I think that everybody, he's basically Trump's Trump. I mean, I think that my guess is, I think Ben Shapiro was probably right about one thing, which was, I think the way he probably got the gig was by kind of going to Trump and reinforcing everything that Trump believed. Now, I'm not saying that was like a Machiavellian ploy to get the gig. I don't know. But, this is a guy who basically will confirm all of Trump's instincts, and if you think those are bad, then it's bad. If you think you need someone to temper him, then this is bad. If you think you need someone to sort of reinforce him, then this is good. I will say this: I think there's like two interesting types of people. I'm sure there's however many people you meet in heaven, there's probably like a dozen different types of people who become Trump supporters. But there's two types that I'm pretty aware of at this point. One is the guy who is teeming with testosterone that wants you to know how macho he is. Like the guy who's super macho, and that guy is almost always a Trump supporter if you ever run into that guy. The other type are these kind of manic and brilliant but grandiose people. And I would put Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani in that camp as well. And I think that's where Bannon fits in. These are guys who they operate outside the consensus. And they are, in a way, you admire them because they sort of refuse to accept reality. And so they live in this alternate universe. And so sometimes that makes them really right. There was this really good review I read recently. It's old, but this review of Newt Gingrich's somebody went through and read all of Newt Gingrich's books. And there are many, many books that Newt has written or co-authored over the years. And at the end of the review, it said, you know, Gingrich postures himself as a futurist, and some of his predictions, such as his 1982 prediction that in the future everybody would have a computer, have turned out pretty well. Other predictions, such as his notion that in the future we'll have giant mirrors to increase the temperature on Earth and extend the growing season, have not fared so well. And so I think that, like, that there's a type of guy that likes Trump and that appreciates him, and I think that Bannon is that category.
So, you know, Greg Sargent at the Washington Post, he had a piece after the Bannon hire saying, on one hand, you have CNN's Brian Stelter, who's the host of Reliable Sources, longtime watcher of cable TV news, as a media reporter, suggesting that to have Bannon and Ailes with Trump, you're essentially putting together your media team for after the election. There's speculation that Trump wants to start a TV network or some other kind of media enterprise, and these hires are basically a step towards that, not so much a step towards winning the election. And the campaign is essentially, you know, recruitment of, you know, of viewers for his next business endeavor. And then Sargent, who explored that and didn't totally dismiss it, but he sort of leaned towards, no, this is really more of a political move, showing that Trump is delusional in believing he can win the election on, you know, right-wing white male grievance alone. Where do you come out on that? Do you think this is politics or is this business?
Well, first let me just do a quick diversion. I think that Stelter has really become really good on TV. I think I feel like he's become really good on TV. And you know who else I think is really good is Steve Kornacki. You and I both used to go on his show, and he was filling in for Rachel Maddow last week. And he starts these shows with these, like, history lessons almost, where he's sort of teaching. Mm-hmm. So I've just, I don't know, there's people, you know, there's some people that have, you know, kind of come into their own this year on TV. But the question is, like, is this like, are they like throwing the race to launch a TV media empire, or are they really trying to win?
I would say I don't think it's necessarily quite an either or.
Yeah.
I think he could be delusional about the election and be thinking ahead to how to monetize this when it's all over.
Bill. That's where I'm at. So I think that it's too cynical to think that this is all, like, you know, a ploy just to launch this media empire. Look, Roger Ailes is out of a job with nowhere else to go. He turned to his good friend, Oscar Madison. And he's friends with Trump. And Trump.
I actually was thinking that, you know, Mike Pence is the Felix Unger. And Trump is the Oscar Madison in that relationship.
That was a great opening. I mean, I've never seen the movie or the play, but the TV show opening. That was a great. I really like that opening. I'm gonna pull that up on YouTube after this. If you haven't seen it, you're too young. But so The Odd Couple. Look, Ailes had nowhere else to go, and Trump is running for president of the United States, and Ailes is great at media prep. So why wouldn't you, you know, bring him on? And then if it happens to be the case that Trump loses. But you have Roger Ailes and Steve Bannon, and you now have, you know, millions of Twitter followers and email lists. You know, would it be a bad idea to parlay that into a media empire that would, like, be profitable and also give you a political voice? I mean, you could argue that you know, you could sort of argue like that the work begins. We may have lost this battle, but we're going to win the war. And if there's a goal to turn the Republican Party into a European style, you know, white identity politics nationalist party, I'm pretty confident that there's a financial market for that, because you only need a sliver of the population, you know, who are like highly motivated and engaged to make it a good business. But if you could sort of, you know, I guess Ivanka could be, Le Pen too. So, you know, I don't think it's a crazy idea, and I don't think that it's mutually exclusive. It could be, we're going to try to win the election, but if it doesn't work, then we're going to, you know, keep it going with TrumpBart.com.
Well, but if it goes beyond just being a media business, if it is also to maintain a political movement, that is more that's more ominous for the future of the Republican Party. We talked about this a little bit last week. I mean, you have a divided party. You have a nativist faction that can't seem to win majority presidential elections. And if that, you know, we've always talked about, you know, that you have to lose three times before you change direction. You know, the left by 1992 was willing to cut loose and say, okay, fine, we'll give up opposing the death penalty fervently. We'll give up protecting welfare benefits. We got to win at this point. If you got a faction on the Trump right that doesn't want to give up, then you're not going to make that turn.
Oh, yeah, no, it's going to be really hard to fix the Republican Party. I mean, people keep saying to me, like, well, if Trump loses, do things just go back to the way they were? And, you know, I don't, number one, I don't know. But number two, like, that is still a huge problem. I mean, things were bad before. I mean, my book, Too Dumb to Fail, was, I started writing it before Donald Trump got in the race. And, Trump didn't create these problems. He exploited them. He's a symptom of them. But if things go back to the way they were before Trump, that still means that the Republican Party has a huge, and the conservative movement have huge problems that they haven't corrected. I mean, there's an argument. Mike Murphy makes the argument, and it's not a crazy point to make, that we needed to have the fight between Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. And that what Trump has done, among many other bad things, is postpone that fight. That was the fight that needed to happen. Like, there had to be a winner emerge between Cruz.
Well, you had a fight between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush, which is essentially along the same lines.
Not really.
And Trump won.
No, but I don't think it's the same. I think it's different.
I mean, you have the immigration fight. Marco wasn't really cheerleading the immigration reform argument. Jeb was, and lost to Trump.
Yeah, but okay. So look, Rubio and Cruz are both Republican politicians within the mainstream of American conservatism, and they're both young, and both sitting U.S. senators. Jeb Bush has the baggage of the Bush dynasty. He's older. Donald Trump isn't a conservative, and he's 70 years old. So, you know, I think that, you know, Murphy's point that we were basically deprived of this opportunity to settle some score, not even scores, but just settle who we are. If Trump goes down in a landslide, then I think, you know, there will be a fight over defining that narrative and assigning blame. But I still think it's entirely possible that 2020 then becomes, you know, and maybe it's not Rubio, maybe it's Ben Sasse, but somebody versus Cruz, you know. So you didn't exercise that, you know, or you did, it's an unsatisfying denouement, shall we say.
I mean, I can understand why you might have preferred that the battle be waged by Rubio and Cruz. But, I mean, it seems to me that the real underlying battle here is, should the Republican Party adapt to appeal to a multicultural America, or should the Republican Party be the voice of people who reject a multicultural America? And I mean, Rubio, I mean, one of the big failures of the Rubio campaign is that he didn't really stake any kind of ground, I mean, not just on that sort of meta question, but really almost much of anything. It was a lot of platitudes. You know, Jeb at least, you know, planted his flag on a number of controversial issues, as did Trump on the other side of the spectrum. And those who are virulently resistant to accepting America's multicultural trajectory flock to Trump. And that battle line, I think, remains inside the Republican Party, because the leading lights do want to turn towards accepting America's multiculturalism, even if they don't necessarily want to embrace things like affirmative action and whatnot. But certainly immigration reform is the most crystallizing touchstone in that argument.
Well, I'm practicava con lo raza, because they know who we
are. What's
that? I'm practicava con lo raza. I'm practically with the race, as they say.
Right.
Not really.
Right.
No, but look, I think here's the deal. I think that there's basically, I just heard about this today at the Daily Caller. I think there's two indispensable things that have to happen if the Republican Party is to correct itself. I think, number one, you have to have the base. In other words, I think that because we live in this world where we have democratized everything, that you can no longer have leaders and elites solve things. I think that you have to have the base on board, and I think that that requires pain. I think that nobody wants to volunteer for change. Change cannot be imposed from top down, but I think it can be brought about through eventually people realize that it's a necessity. Sometimes people die. You know, I mean, that's what I talked to a guy who was part of the DLC. And he, you know, we're talking about this, and he said, he basically said that, like, it's like people don't change their minds, that you just have to wait till they die. So that's a long process. I also think you need new leaders to emerge. And I think, like, you know, at the risk of advocating the great man theory of politics, I do think that, you know, you have to have the sort of the fertile soil, you have to have the base that is finally lost enough that they're ready to make some compromises. And then I think you have to have a unifying, charismatic leader emerge as the nominee who can bring people together. Like, that's a really super tall order. But I honestly don't think there's any way the Republican Party could revitalize without both of those ingredients happening.
Well, let me shift gears to the upcoming debates. I had a piece in Politico about this that went up on Tuesday, because we had the final announcement, which is, I suppose that there's still a couple more announcements from the debate commission to come, who the moderators are, the topics for the debates. But the big announcement was what polls they will use to decide who gets invites. And, you know, as of 2000, they established a 15% threshold in an average of five polls, and the commission determines which five polls each year. And the polls they use aren't that random. You know, for example, in 2012, they used ABC Washington Post, NBC Wall Street Journal, CBS, New York Times, Fox News, and Gallup. This year, and Gallup, I should point out, Gallup, the head of Gallup, Frank Newport, consults with the commission to make these determinations. Now, but Gallup, you may recall, botched the 2012 election. They predicted Romney would win by 1 point, and Obama ended up winning by 3 points. Now, you can say, well, that's not that big of a botch. It's still sort of the margin of error. But they kind of went out there and said, Romney's going to win. And then they released a big mea culpa report exploring why their likely voter model was off base. And this year, they have not done any trial heat polling, but they haven't really, I don't think they've made an announcement about that fact. They just haven't done it. So instead of Gallup being in the five, it's CNN. So it's ABC, Washington Post, NBC, Wall Street Journal, CBS, New York Times, Fox, CNN. So it's the five networks. So that's not a crazy thing to do. But what was unsaid, but still really important in the decision is, ABC, NBC, and and CNN have been doing four-way polling, including Libertarian Gary Johnson and Green Party's Jill Stein, whereas Fox and CBS New York Times had so far only done three-way polls with Gary Johnson, but not Jill Stein. After this announcement, Fox announces our next poll will have Jill Stein. So you're going to have at least four of the five doing a four-way poll and not a three-way poll. And a four-way poll is not helpful to Gary Johnson. In the last CBS New York Times poll, which only had Gary Johnson, he was at 12%. In the Fox News poll that only had Gary Johnson, he was at 12%. Whereas in the other three, he's been at an average of 9, not 12. While Jill Stein has averaged about 5.
Sorry, what's the threshold?
15.
15, okay.
So as it stands, he wouldn't get in no matter what the scenario. But 12 is closer than 9. If Jill Stein is in the mix, they are splitting the Bernie Sanders vote. Gary Johnson does better with independents. He gets 16% of independents, but Stein gets 8 because there are left-wing independents out there. You know, so she is a bit of an anchor, pulling Johnson down, making it even harder to get to that 15, which is already going to be a bit of a reach. And there's nothing really he can do about that right now. I mean, even if CBS still does a three-way, his average is going to be based on the four-way polls in the other four polls. And so that number gets diluted. And you really can't argue that this is unfair. She's going to be in a lot of state ballots. You know, she is as much in the mix as he is. It would be an arbitrary move to cut her out. But it has the effect of most likely keeping Johnson out of the debate, even though he has a decent amount of support. There's two ways to look at that. You can say this is more evidence that the whole thing is rigged, and this is a collusion of the Democrats and Republicans to keep third parties out. Or you could say, but my conclusion is, look, you know, the complaint before was that we're not even getting mentioned in the polls. How could you make this a criteria when the pollsters don't even mention us? Well, now you got mentioned. You've been mentioned the whole way through. You've got in TV time. Gary Johnson had 2 CNN televised town halls. Jill Stein has had 1. They've got, you know, Johnson was on Meet the Press. Stein's been on, I think, all the cable networks. And you even have the fortune of going up against the Republican who's not even spending money on TV ads. The Greens and Libertarians are outspending Trump on TV ads because Trump is spending 0. So you couldn't have had more of an opportunity to prove yourself. And I'm sure folks are going to say, they didn't get nearly as much media time as everybody else is getting. It's still unfair. Look, Bernie Sanders didn't go into this getting even treatment from the get-go. He went out and he earned it. They've had enough opportunity to earn it. And if you can't get to 15 and show you have a distinct segment of the population that's behind you,
yeah,
why should you get the most rarefied FaceTime, have more than half the country watching?
I agree. And if ever there was an opportunity to get 15%, it would be when Hillary Clinton runs against Donald Trump. So they haven't capitalized. But let me ask you this. Who does this help? Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
Well, I would say it helps Hillary Clinton in this respect. By and large, the polling with Stein and Johnson combined is basically a wash. You know, there are certain polls where it takes a little bit out of Hillary, But with the lead as big as it is, it doesn't amount to a spoiler effect. We're not seeing state polls where the two of them together are tipping the election one way or the other. So having them both in or both out, you know, is a non-factor. If Gary Johnson got in by himself, you know, maybe that's a little bit worse for Trump. But him being the single independent candidate, the third party candidate, would end up making him a default option for the Bernie people who don't like Hillary. So I think that would be probably a net wash too. What is helpful to Hillary is that if the polls stay as they are, and third party candidates tend to flame out, so that's not an assumption you could say is a firm one, but Gary Johnson is more likely to clear 5% going on election day than Jill Stein is. Stein has to hold what she has, maybe get a little bit more if she's going to clear that, and her trick is probably going to go down. Johnson can go down and still clear 5% because I think you have a harder faction of Never Trump Republicans out there who are going to go with him. If the Libertarians clear 5%, they will be classified as an official minor party by the Federal Election Commission and get a windfall of cash for 2020 and have more instant ballot access on a state-by-state basis. Every state's rules are different, but they will likely get free pass on more of them. That's what Jill Stein and the Greens want to get for themselves. If they don't get it, then only one third party gets that status, and they're more likely to be a drag on the Republicans going forward. If they both got in, then the Greens would be a drag on the Democrats going forward. So I think that the net of all this is that the Republicans risk having more entrenched division than the Democrats do.
We can't argue about that.
It's what one more, you know, I mean, they're already divided as it is, and they're already on these multicultural type issues. If you lose the economic libertarians, you lose the free traders, then the job of piecing the party back together gets even more complicated.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's going to be an interesting time. Luckily for everybody watching, we'll be here to cover that.
I want to make one more point about this 50% threshold, though, because obviously people are going to say, well, look, if people want more voices. You know, polls show people don't want to be a two-party duopoly. They don't really like Hillary Clinton. You know, why shouldn't there be a different voice they're arguing for issues and positions that, you know, Hillary and Clinton and Trump don't articulate? I think the problem there is that, yeah, there is definitely a faction of the country that is not directly represented by the Democratic and the Republican platforms, but that pool of people is not ideologically monolithic by a long shot. If
right.
they were, they'd all be libertarian. I mean, the problem is that there isn't 15% that is squarely behind the libertarian platform. Despite these guys have been a party for over 30 years, so if there was that appetite, you know, again, this is the year you could prove that. The problem is they have a mishmash of positions. I mean, there's a certain degree of overlap on the left and a certain degree of overlap on the right, but it doesn't gel to it being a true, robust third party, at least as it stands today.
But I think if Rand Paul were the Libertarian nominee, he would be at 20%. You know, he'd be at Ross Perot levels right now.
Well, that's a big assumption. I mean, arguably, Ron Paul is crazier than Gary Johnson is.
I'm sorry, did I say Ron? I mean, Rand Paul.
Rand Paul.
Did I say Ron? I meant Rand.
Well, but he isn't doing it. He has chosen to be, relatively speaking, more of a mainstream Republican. He has not gone on the far ledge of pure libertarianism in his role as senator. And Gary Johnson has, relatively speaking, and he's going to perform.
Gary Johnson's not.
In what respect?
Well, I think
I don't like religious liberty.
Yeah, which is a huge issue. I mean, it's in the First Amendment. I mean, if you look, I'm not saying libertarianism. I think we talked about this before. Like, I'm not saying libertarianism is right or wrong. But if you're a libertarian, then you should believe that the government can't use force to compel somebody to bake a cake for somebody else. That's what libertarians are.
This is the problem. There is a split within libertarianism on how to deal with these social conservative issues, and Rand Paul is more of a social conservative.
This is different.
And Gary Johnson's definition. That together into a robust party.
I disagree. I think your explanation for that is right when it comes to the life issue, that libertarians are divided over that. Libertarians are not divided over religious liberty. Gary Johnson's definition of what a libertarian is inaccurate. He says it's somebody who is socially liberal and economically conservative. That is not what a coherent libertarian philosophy is.
According to the school of Matt Lewis's libertarianism, but
no, I mean,
Gary Johnson is the Libertarian Party nominee, so a bunch of libertarian delegates agreed with his view.
No, look, there are people like, Rothbard and Murray and Thomas E. Woods and Ron Paul who have talked about what, libertarian, I mean, there's a libertarian philosophy, which may or may not be like right, but there is a philosophy, and Gary Johnson is not a good libertarian in accordance with that philosophy.
Wait, this is the People's Front of Judea versus the Judaic People's Front. There's a splintering. I mean, once you get into the weeds of the anti-duopoly individuals, there are just lots of different strains of political thought that don't add up to a coherent third party, which is why they're not getting into debates and are not going to be a big factor come election day. You have to. If there's going to be a robust libertarian party, it's going to have to come down on these questions in a fashion that appeals to a large segment of the public.
I think I said Murray and Rothbard. People will know what I mean by that. But look, you're right. I mean, we're I'm not a libertarian scholar. I would love for someone, but I talk to them. I study it. I mean, as much as I can. When it comes to economics, I mean, Mises and all that, I mean, I'm pretty Austrian, but so look, I would love for some real libertarians out there, to school me on this, but I think, and I'm sure they will, but I think I'm right on this. I mean, I think it's fair to say that Gary Johnson's definition is social liberal, economic, fiscally conservative, and that is an inaccurate, that is not what libertarianism means.
Well, beyond the questions of philosophical purity, I mean, we've talked about this before, social conservatives lack a political home right now. Trump is not a true blue social conservative. Libertarian Party, has moved away from the Paul brand, which was more socially conservative, to a Gary Johnson brand, which is social liberal. So the idea for the libertarians is this is going to be more appealing to the anti-democratic left, and the younger generation is more socially liberal. So that's a growth market. But you're arguing that, hey, social conservatives are literally politically homeless right now. They got to go somewhere eventually. And if the Republican Party is going to snub them and the Libertarian Party is going to snub them, what are we going to do here? So someone's got to be able to scoop that up and show that there's a political market for that.
Yeah. So from what I know about libertarianism, it's about this thing they call the non-aggression principle. And fundamentally, when you use the coercive force of big government to compel people to do things, that would be, by definition, non-libertarian. So that's got nothing to do with the fact that I am pro-life. Like, if Gary Johnson were pro-choice but defended religious liberty, I would say that he could still be and not that I'm the final arbiter of this, but in my opinion, he would still be a fine libertarian based on those two issues. Now, look, if Rand Paul were the nominee, because he is also pro-life, I think you would have a lot of people like me who are conservatives who think Donald Trump is unacceptable who would be voting for Rand Paul. And then he might also pull libertarians based on the fact that he is, you know, for decriminalization of marijuana, that he's non-interventionist in terms of his foreign policy, that he's a free marketer and with a Republican and a Democratic candidate who are both sort of playing to the protectionist side. So I think strategically speaking, Rand Paul would make a lot of sense. And I think Rand Paul's more of a libertarian than Gary Johnson is.
And just to be clear to folks who didn't hear us talk with us before or read you with us before, what you're upset about is that Gary Johnson is siding with folks who say private businesses should not be allowed to discriminate against people because they are LGBT.
Or
it's the whole.
I mean, that's one way of framing it. The other way would say that people, you know, the dwindling number of people who have very deep abiding religious convictions should not be compelled to violate their rights of conscience. I mean, you know, you can frame it either way. And my point is, like, it doesn't matter to me whether that's good or bad, right or wrong. But if you are a libertarian, where you come down on that issue is obvious. A libertarian would obviously, by definition, side with the individual's right to do basically as long as he is not hurting somebody. This would be the non-aggression principle. To do what they want with the business that they own. Now, obviously, this leads us into a very slippery slope where we start talking about Jim Crow and people at lunch counters. And remember, Rand Paul became embroiled in that controversy with Rachel Maddow. And I think Gary Johnson wants to avoid that, you know, for political purposes.
Well, and Glenn Beck was pushing him on that when Gary Johnson was. Glenn Beck was saying, "Look, there's no parallel there. There's no religious scripture that compels one to deny blacks a seat at a lunch counter. There is religious scripture that's against homosexuality." And you know, I think the counter to that is, well, there's nothing about you know, baking a wedding cake or being a wedding photographer that says you have violated some biblical scripture. You can still think that homosexuality is a sin. You haven't committed that sin by taking a photo.
Yes, but if you believe believe that your work is a vocation and a calling, and that the sweat equity that you put into it says something about who you. I mean, we can go through this and through this, but my point being, like, libertarianism. I'm not a libertarian, so I don't think it's the right philosophy, but. But if it stands for anything, it stands for the individual to have liberty and freedom, and not for you know, big government to force you to do what they want you to do. So I mean, that's basically what it is, I think.
So I mean, these are sticky subjects,
but yet we are in the DMZ, which is a warm, comfy nest.
But the DMZ is a wonderful, warm, fuzzy place, but there cannot be a DMZ party. We would not get the 15% in the polls if we ran together as a ticket. We would be a mess. So the Democratic and Republican parties, I mean, we have a two-party system because they occupy two basic poles of thought on role of government, and they, you know, they sand out the rough edges on both sides of the ideological spectrum, which would inevitably get sanded out even in a multi-party system. Which, if you had six parties in parliament, you'd come up to these, you have compromise proposals at that stage of the game. I mean, that's why it's pretty resilient. And in fact, there's a great piece by Julia Azari in Politico this week, saying that's sort of premised on why is it so hard for the Republican Party to collapse. I mean, this is a party that's been around for 160 years. that is totally different than what it was in the mid-19th century. It was based on being anti-slavery and has gone through many stages of evolution since then, and the Democratic Party even more so. I mean, that's an even older party, and it's had many chapters in its history.
It's really hard. But it's really hard to equate them. I mean, you go back, you go back to the founding, and even just never mind the party. Just this is mentioned in my book. Like, what is Thomas Jefferson? Like, is he a conservative? Like, that's a real debatable question. You know, I mean, there's, you know, I mean, it's really apples and oranges at this point.
Right. Well, but you know, but Azari's point is that, you know, outside of the ideological element, structurally, the two parties have built an infrastructure that serves the political process and is not easily dismantled. It is easier for the existing parties to adapt to ideological shifts in the country than to build a party from total scratch. And you know, if you have like a Ross Perot type deal where they're okay, we have this boomlet about deficit reduction. Well, Bill Clinton scooped it up. And then the party adapted to absorb that viewpoint. That was easier than building a reform party on that basis. If you try to build a third party based on opposition to trade because there are elements who don't like where the two party leaderships are on the subject, it would break apart on a number of other factors. It's just a big institutional hurdle to do.
No, I agree, and I think that you end up these parties fill, they respond to market forces. They want to fill a niche. The problem I think Republicans have is that Democrats have the first mover advantage on so much. So once Democrats corner the market on being the cosmopolitan minority party, then the smart move for Republicans to do is to go the opposite direction. Let's corner the market on being the working class white populist party. I mean, this in a sense makes sense from a business standpoint.
Except they're getting the short end of the deal because there's not enough votes there.
Yeah, because you would never. This is not. You would never, given the choice. You would if you could say it, given the choice, you would say, well, let's go with the people who are becoming larger in number, not the people who are dwindling in number. You know?
Well, there's a piece in the Times today by Thomas Edsel that talks about there's potential problems for Democrats in the near future because that affluent white and people of color combination, you know, there's income gap, there's income friction there that could pull that coalition apart.
Well,
Michael...
I mean, just it's impossible for... Look, once your coalition becomes too big, it can't please everybody, right?
So that's always the problem of winning. That's always your first world problem. It's easier to be unified in opposition, and it's harder to keep a broad coalition together when you're in power.
Right. So Democrats now are probably losing the union worker, the Russ, you know, they very well get, you know, Iowa. I mean, Iowa is a classic example. I mean, Iowa is a state that has gone blue a lot lately, and Trump actually looks like he might win Iowa.
Yeah, that's probably his best possibility to pick off an Obama state is Iowa. It's just not enough. He's doing better there than he's doing in Ohio. And even if he won Iowa, I mean, he could win Iowa, Ohio, and Florida and still lose because Pennsylvania seems out of reach. Pennsylvania has 20 electoral votes, and that's almost necessary. I mean, if he wasn't going to win Pennsylvania, he'd have to win so many other places that it would seem impossible when you're losing nationally by, you know, 6 to 10 points. Perhaps we should leave it on that note, sir.
Yes. We're taking a vacation. Bill and I will be together. We vacation together. Our wives and children will, you know, they'll miss us. But Bill and I will be doing a tour of some Major League Baseball stadiums.
Now, if we're doing some minor league baseball stadiums, I would go with you.
The Omaha Golden Spikes open a homestand against the Frederick Keys. Anyway, no, we will both be on separate vacations. We will not be in the DMZ next week.
So are we doing the classic liberal Maine vacation, and you'll be doing the classic Republican Arizona summer vacation in a giant air-conditioned resort?
I have to shore things up for John McCain. but while we're away, I don't know, maybe they could re-air like a classic episode or something. We've got an incredible catalog, an oeuvre.
That's true.
That is, I don't know, I would bet that nobody else has done more Blogging Heads episodes than us by this point. I mean, I know like people like Mickey Kouse and, you know, they probably racked up a big number a long time ago, but there's no way that anyone's done more of these episodes than us, right?
I have to check with Blogging at Central on that. We may be the record holders for number of shows and duration of show. There's got to be a pretty good supercut we could do a Madam Bill montage at the end of our long run.
Remember the first time I tried to leave, and then they decided wouldn't let me leave. But the first time I tried to, they actually did a montage with, you know, that, I think it, who's it's the Arms of the Angel. It's a song they play for like, is it PETA or no? It's like, I don't know. It's something about abusing animals like, I don't know.
The Sarah McLachlan song?
Yeah. And it was like a montage. I think that was the background music. And there was a montage of us. But we were much younger back then. I mean, we've been doing that. That was like 5 years ago that I tried to leave you. I can't leave you. I can't quit you, yeah. Bill.
I'm too magnetic.
That's why we vacationed together in the Carolina League. So the Durham Bulls open a homestand, and we shall be there. So
I'll be near the Portland Sea Dogs. I believe next year, you know, the New Britain Rock Cats in Connecticut are moving to Hartford, becoming the Hartford Yard Goats. That's only 45 minutes away from me. So if you ever want to check out the Yard Goats, you know, we'll meet up there.
Honestly, I wish there were a minor league team. There's like the Shorebirds and the Bowie Bay Sox or something.
I've seen the Bowie Bay Sox. They're not too far from D.C.
Well, yeah, but it's actually closer just to go to D.C. Like, my kids, I feel like I wouldn't mind dropping, you know, $5 or $10 for them to go see some games. But it's actually harder than going to see the Nats or the Orioles, probably. So I might as well, right. You know, and then now we're talking real money because, you know, beer alone that I consume at these games is...
There's no Virginia team right now?
I mean, maybe somewhere, but not in Northern Virginia that I know of. I mean, there's, you know, so. All right, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Stay out of trouble, don't do anything I wouldn't do, and follow us at DMZ Show on Twitter.
All right,
see ya.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.